So, Roy, can you tell me when and where you were born?
I was born in Delmead, Alberta, Canada, on the 26th day of May, 1914. And I lived there until I was six, and then we moved back to, down to Washington, Lane, Washington, where we moved to then. And I went through school there, and through high school in Blaine, Washington. I moved down here in 32 and graduated from the class of 33 in the grand year.
Well, when you moved down here, that was your senior year.
Yes.
And when you moved here, how did you find it different from where you lived up there, coming just for your senior year?
Pretty rough. Pretty rough. Kind of a loner, but I played baseball. When I got to playing baseball, I was right amongst the rest of them. That just made me one of the bunch.
When you had a sport.
Yeah.
You came from a family of 13, seven sisters and six brothers.
Right, five brothers.
Five brothers.
Yeah.
And that's quite a... quite a family.
Yeah. I shouldn't ought to tell you this, but I would tell everybody that. My dad still had time enough to fish.
Well, you told me that you came down to Rennie Clark's farm, and that was because she was Mrs. Clark was related to you.
Yeah.
And this was during Depression times, and tell us a little bit, what prompted you to move to Union County?
Well, all them kids, of course some of them had gone, left out in, but things was pretty tough up there, and then. And they wanted us to come down here and run the dairy and milk their cows and stuff. And so that's what we did. We came down here and milked the cows for over a year. And then Rennie Clark got ideas of his own, and so we split ways, and then we moved out to Jordan. Oh, what the hell was it?
It's all right.
Yeah, they had a dairy out there on Clark Place. A guy by the name of Railroader, by the name of Jordan, was running it.
Uh-huh.
And he couldn't, he was too much work for them. So we bought them out and started the dairy out there. And he was bottling milk and delivering milk in bottle in town. And we did that for a long time. And
well, when you were at Clark's, you took the milk to the Blue Mountain Creamery.
Yes.
Is that correct?
That's right.
Now, going to high school, and I imagine you had to work on the farm, did that interfere with your activities at school?
A little bit. But the activities, I mean, school come first, or the dairy come first.
Well, I can appreciate
that.
You had to earn a living.
It worked out. There's enough of us that we could, one guy could go do what he wanted to do, play ball games someplace else, and the rest of them would pick up the slack.
And during that time, you had some time off because somebody else would help, and you could have entertainment in town and attend school functions and things like that. So it wasn't all work. It was hard work when you were working, but you did have a little bit of time.
The milking part of it was steady.
Uh-huh.
You had to do that at a certain time each day and night.
Then you graduated from high school in 1933.
Yes.
And when did you move out to the other farm?
we moved out there. Must have been in the late 30s.
Uh-huh. And then you say you bottled the milk at that time, and then did you do home deliveries?
Yes.
And you sold milk for how much a quart?
12 cents a quart. When the war started, they froze the price of everything. And we sold it for, delivered it for 12 cents. And delivered to stores at 10 cents. And, when I delivered the milk in the, to the houses, sometimes they take the bottle and turn it into the store for the dime, so I didn't make much on that deal. But we straightened that out pretty fast.
You had to have a little understanding with the customer that they returned the bottles that you left the milk in. I know the first time I met you was probably about 1943, I think, just before you married Lee Wilcox.
Yeah.
And did you meet her by going into the Wilcox store, delivering milk?
Delivered milk in there, yeah.
Uh-huh. And,
how long we lived out there? We moved on this place in 41.
Uh-huh.
We moved out. They took us away from that Clark place, or not Clark, but
Noise
place.
Uh-huh. This place is the one across from the Island City Cemetery on the McAllister Road.
Well, we moved out to Hot Lake for a year.
Uh-huh.
I did build a milk house out there. But there was a lot of disease out there in that layout. I got in trouble with Bang disease and the cows and stuff. So we rented this place in 41.
Did you have milking machines in those days?
I didn't then when I first moved out there, but I sure did after we got there.
About how many cows were you milking at the time?
Well, we were milking 30-some at the time we moved out there. But when we got here and set up, we were milking 50 cows. We had milking machines then.
And that was quite a lot of...
Quite a change, yeah. That's quite a lot of milk to handle, too. Moisture bottles and stuff at us.
And that's 7 days a week.
Yes. I thought of, in 385 year days of the year, too.
Well, when you went along, how long did you continue operating the dairy? You said you then went into raising sheep?
Yeah, I sold it. Went into Valley Dairy.
Uh-huh.
And I sold, when they were starting with, and I sold them my bottles and customers and stuff that I had there. And then in 55, I sold the cows and quit the dairy business altogether.
Uh-huh.
And the last 5 years that I was milking cows, I was, my wife or I was neither one away from home overnight for 5 years. And that's too darn long.
Makes a dull person. What time did you start in the morning?
4 o'clock.
4 o'clock. Then you had to milk that night. What time did you usually quit in the evening?
Well, we always milked at 4 o'clock in the morning and 4 o'clock at night. We was harvesting our hay and whatever, but when 4 o'clock come, we was milking.
But how, at night, when we were able to quit, go to bed, about what time was that?
Well, when Fred was working with me, we was working about 18 hours a day.
Fred, that was your brother?
Yes, my brother, yeah.
Uh-huh.
That's what we figured, but in about 18 hours, we was on the go.
And at those times, you didn't make any big money. Some of these things that people have today, like boats and trailers and four-wheel drives, it took you something like 40 or 50 years to accumulate. Is that correct?
It took quite a while to even think about that kind of stuff. I don't know. We knew. I don't remember when I took over the dairy from the family. I took over. My dad didn't like it. He wanted to cut wood and stuff. And my mother worked with us. We boasted and bottled and milked and stuff. All the kids helped.
You were saying your dad cut wood and sold it for, what, $12 a quart?
$11 and $12 a quart. Delivered, put in their shed.
And it was a long time before he got a chainsaw.
Right, right. Lots of times I went up and pulled the end of a crosscut saw to help me fall some of them trees.
How many acres on Mount Emily did you say that he bought for $600?
40.
40 acres.
Yeah. And I don't know how many cords of wood he sold out there, but he sold a lot of wood. And then he made a deal with the Stang's Mill. And sold the place we bought for $600. He sold it for $10,000. But the only way he'd sell it was if he could cut wood on their property anytime he wanted to. And so that made a deal, and he sold it.
But you told me he never cut another stick of wood.
He just quit right there. He just did everything else, fishing, but he never cut any more wood.
Well, that's an interesting thing.
He wore out three of them weight drag saws before he got the chainsaw. So he was a pretty busy man. He spent long days up there cutting that wood. He finally got smart enough so that he'd go up there in the morning and he'd load his pickup with wood. So when he got tired in the afternoon, all they had to do was get the pickup and drive home.
Well, that was usually said.
Yeah, that's right. But we used to haul the cordwood out here and stack it in this field out here, and then I had a buzzsaw. Mm-hmm. And we saw it up in 16-inch lengths, and then he'd stack it again. And then people would buy it, so he'd have to load it in his pickup and haul it up to their place and unload it in their woodshed or whatever for $11 and $12 a cord.
Well, that wood warms you up more than once.
You know, and we had some of it stacked along the fence out here. And people going hunting. Captain Hunting would stop and steal some off the top of that ricks along the fence out here so they'd have dry wood. They'd go and take out into the woods to have a fire.
Well, you said then you sold the cows and you went into the sheep business.
Yeah.
And what were some of the problems that you learned about the sheep business?
Getting up all hours of the night when lambing time come. Because they lambed when they wanted to do it, and if you wasn't there to pen them off while they nursed a while, they couldn't keep track of their own darn lambs. So we had to take them and put them in a pen. If we knew when they were, if we could figure out when they was going to lamb, well, we'd put them in a separate. But if they was out with a bunch, sometimes you had a heck of a time putting the right lamb on the right ewe.
Well, how come you picked sheep?
Lack of experience.
You told me then when you sheared the sheep and went to sell the wool that you had such a small amount to sell that nobody was interested in buying it.
Right.
And you and some other fellows formed a co-op together so that you had enough wool to offer the buyers. Is that correct?
Martin Schwartz and I started it. Old Chuck Gavin was the county agent on the livestock end of things that time, and he helped us farm this. We went around to all the sheep growers we knew in the county and told them the story. And there's just a very few that wouldn't sell to us at first because they had a deal with some outfit in Portland. And when they found out what we was doing and how it was working out, well, they quit them and they all come to us. And, oh, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 years, we went from Union County sheep growers to Wallowa County and then Baker County, Tri-City outfit.
You can always get a better price for volume than you can just small.
Yeah, when we were selling us guys, we didn't even have a carload, and we were selling 4 and 5 carloads of wool, all of them together.
What did they pay for wool?
It was getting 60 cents a pound. And then when we started forming the corporation, we always got up at least 70 then. That's how much we gained by having a several carloads.
How many sheep were you?
I was running about 300.
About 300 head of sheep?
Yeah.
It quite a lot to take care of.
Yeah. Yes. Especially at lambing time.
Then did you sell some sheep to be butchered?
Or? Oh, yeah, lambs. We sold lambs.
Too. Lambs,
yeah. That went along with, well, that was a little easy, but that put us in contact where several of us could go together and sell lambs.
Who, the slaughterhouse locally buy it, or
no,
did you take
it to the
sale yard?
Sale yard, yeah.
Uh-huh. But along there, you said that you wanted to form a fire district. And can you tell me a little bit about that? How you for the rural fire district?
We got to talking about it, and so there was 5 of us went together to start it, get signatures. I can't remember whether it was old Dixon, the lawyer, told us how to start it. And we went out and got signatures, and we had several meetings. We formed a boundary line for this district. We couldn't get LeGrand. Island City, the city of Island City, wouldn't join us. And we couldn't infringe on the Forestry Service, but we didn't want a space between the Forest Service and no man's land. It took us pretty near a year to get all the signatures and stuff needed on that. And then the 5 of us that were getting all the signatures, they made a committee out of us.
Who was the committee?
There's August Erickson, Skinny Wardell, Shorty Blocklund. How many did that make? Myself, of course. There was 5 of us.
There's 4, so we need one more.
I don't know. I believe Ed Consul wanted in on it. And we went up to Dixon's office, and he helped us organize it, set her up. And he had to have a chairman. We put 5 numbers in the hat and drawed out the numbers. Well, I was slow. I didn't draw out. I just took the last one. And it happened to be number 1. So that made me chairman of the board. And I wasn't smart enough to get out of it. I'd been there for 30 years. But we did a lot in that with that fire district.
Well, how did you acquire equipment and set it up so that volunteers would take out
taxes?
You got a tax.
Yeah.
And we had to have a petition. And
every year we had a vote on that, the taxes. And we did so good, and they could see so much help. Even the insurance company cut their fire insurance rates down. So we got help all over.
Well, that was one of the main reasons that you wanted to form a district, so that your cost of your fire insurance had come down, as well as having protection for your property.
LeGrand talked about running it for what use they could get out of it. But the old fire district or chief up there, he didn't believe it. And he said that we had nothing that would be any good to them. So Island City said, well, we'll man it for the use of it. And so that's the way we started then. And it very wasn't very long until Island City wasn't, and they had enough power, so we went back to, they joined the district, and then we, the whole district hired, hired.
Do you recall what the first fire truck cost?
No, it was built in Portland. I know it was in 51, because that's the first truck was 51, and that's when the district was started.
And was it a Mac?
And it was a Ford 4x4. We were smart enough to have four-wheel drive for winter time.
That was a good idea.
And several times, the city of LeGrand couldn't get up to the south end of 4th Street on account of the snow, and they had to have us come and help. But we had four-wheel drive, and we could go up there to the fires. So they kind of had their words after a while.
I worked at the city of LeGrand during that time in the recorder treasurer's office. I remember when that was started.
Yeah.
The city of LeGrand did have some contracts with certain businesses outside the LeGrand district.
Yeah. They would... LeGrand would go, if there was a house on fire, just off of their district. They'd go and sit there and watch that house burn to protect any other houses that was in the district. After the rural fire engine got treated, we made darn sure that that changed. If there was a fire there and you got to it, you worked on it, put it out or tried to until the other guys got here. And sometimes some of LeGrand houses was on fire in Island City, beat the LeGrand trucks to the fire. So we changed that all around. Boy, we worked together, the two districts, after that.
Well, that's great. It should work together.
And we formed a Fire Chiefs Association. And Baker, all had officers in that. I was chairman of that for a while too, but I belonged to it a lot.
Remember who your first fire chief was?
I think it was Ed Draper.
Oh.
And then
Ed Draper worked for the flouring mill.
Yeah.
Now Parley Hutchison was the fire chief.
He's the one that said that we didn't have anything that would be of any value to the
city of LeGrand.
He sure had his words a lot of times. All the time as I was in there, they wanted anything and put it up to the vote of the people. It was never, ever turned down. We put a bill in there so much, it took so much taxes. They never, ever turned us down, even when they got into this big stuff.
That spoke well for the department.
Yeah, what it could do, yeah.
And they have a nice department today.
Well, it is known as one of the best in the state of Oregon. It was for a long time, anyway. And one time, Island City got an error. They wanted to change it from LeGrand Rural to Island City. And I was one of the ones that stopped that. Said we're known all over the state for Oregon as one of the best, and the cost of changing it over isn't worth what little we gained by having LeGrand stuck on the front of that. Everybody around here knows what it is. with them.
You said you were on that for 30 years.
I was chairman the first 30 years of it.
Uh-huh. And then you got off of it. What? Tell us a little bit what happened when you got off of it.
Well, I took over the chairman of the Island City Rural Fire Cemetery District. And I've been chairman of it ever since. But we formed a district, cemetery district, too, after I joined that group. We had much luck with the fire district. But we didn't start high enough. We just taxed what we needed. And, of course, everything else goes up, too. But so we're having a little trouble now keeping enough money in the fire district, you know, but we're still keeping it, one of the better ones in the county.
Well, the fellow that had been chairman, he said that if you'd take over the cemetery district, he'd run for
on the
rural fire department.
Yeah, right. But he didn't make it, but I did. I don't know, voting for the fire district board members, if three guys would go in and vote, well, you would get your job back.
Well, with all those sheep and things, when was the first time that you were able to, you became a rock town?
Well, that was after, quite a bit after.
Well, I figured it was quite a bit after.
Yeah.
And you trailered for a number of years?
Yeah. Most of that was done after my first wife died and I married Larie.
Uh-huh.
It's when we got to the trailers.
That was about 19... what?
Well, 51 or 2. No, 81 or 2.
Yeah.
Because we've been married 20 years.
I had known Lee from Wilcox's Grocery and her father down there.
Yeah.
And where I first met you. But then life got a little bit easier so that you could take some time.
Yeah.
And what did you like to do the most? Be a rock hound or hunting, fishing?
Fishing. I like to fish and hunt. And a rock hound became a rock hound because my older sister and her daughter were rock hounds, and her husband got into it, and then finally somebody uptown that was a rock hound did all his work in the basement. I never kept the dust down. When you're running rock soil and working in rocks, you get a lot of dirt. And one of the other guys in that rock club, there used to be over 100 people in it.
He used to show things at the county fair.
Oh, yeah. And one of the guys got one of them. I'd have a lung taken out on account of the dirt from working in not enough ventilation and stuff. So my brother-in-law, he quit it, and he made her quit it. He wouldn't let her run any other stuff. And so I told her, well, I'll set it up down here, and she could use it, come down here and use it any time she wanted to. She thought that was wonderful, so I took all her equipment and set it up out there in the shop.
And you have a regular shop where you can
cut the rocks and stuff. And she never came down and used it. She brought stuff down for me to do for her. She never came down and used any of that equipment out there. So.
You still got your showcase and everything down in the basement where you display your gems that you've polished and cut?
I'm kind of crazy. When women come down here, I want to see the rocks and I show them to them. I tell them we're going to run a little contest here. If you can pick out the best one, the prettiest one in there, you can have it. Well, how do we know what's the prettiest one? Well, that's your problem, Papa. Boy, you can just see the wheels going around when they're picking them. And then when they pick one out, boy, I look at it and I say, no, that ain't the prettiest one, but it's close enough. And that's advertisement I get. They take a talk to somebody else. I don't go to the shows anymore. I used to. I have two or three yard sales here, and people pick it up, finger it all over, and look at it, and wouldn't buy it. They go to a commercial rock show or place that sells that stuff, pay three times as much as what I wanted, to my knowledge, it wasn't a damn bit better than mine. But that's the way it goes. So I hate to have them come and finger it all over and stuff and then lay it down and walk off.
People are funny that way. They never seem to want to pay something for it, and then they'll go someplace and pay more.
That's right, yeah. But,
that's the way with life. Then you belong to the Trailer Club?
Yeah, the Good Sam Club.
Uh-huh.
Belong to Blue Mountain Gem Club. That was the rock outfit.
And sometimes you take your trailer and go down to, where is it?
Utah. Topaz Mountain is where we like to go in Utah. We went down there and camp out in the desert amongst the sagebrush for a week.
Hunt for thunder eggs? Mm-hmm.
Down there at Topaz Mountain, we hunted for topaz.
Topaz.
Yeah.
But you have cut thunder.
Good Sam was with us on that, or what? We took our trailers and we made a circle out there like the Indians used to. And it was an ex-gravel pit for the county. And we got a circle out there. That's where we parked our trailers and then hunted rocks from there. And we had a lot of fun. A lot of us did that.
A lot of good comradeship and meals and just good friends.
Yeah. Lots of wild stories told. Yeah. But I'm too old for that anymore. I mean, not too old, but I'm not sure enough of foot to be wandering around in them rock stuff looking for rocks.
Well, fall and get hurt. You
That's
wouldn't
right.
want to do that. Well, how long did you raise sheep?
It was after 55 when I sold the dairy. I didn't have sheep when you and I were married, did I?
No, you had worked for Willie Hammond for 11 years.
Not too long. That sheep business got too much for us. So we quit the sheep. And I run the cream route for 10 years. And I worked for Willie Hammond for 10 years.
What did you do for Willie?
Everything he wanted.
Is that after he moved out to the Beasting place?
Oh, yeah, yeah. He had his house built out there and everything.
Uh-huh.
And him and I and one extra man run that whole place out there for 10 years, one year.
Well, was Bob Gulshole, was he with Willie at that time?
They lived right across the lane from each other.
But they didn't do things together.
No, they did together, but not much. They did their harvesting and stuff. But they worked together. And then his son-in-law come, married Becky, his second daughter's. You know, he was a college guy. He wanted to go to college. He was going to become a veterinary. And he was working out there, and he got through college in Oregon, and he had to wait 2 years before he could get into veterinary college in Washington. And he was working out there helping us. He was a good enough guy. We got an argument. I used to talk. His wife said I talked to him there. But anyway, I told him, if you're smart, well, you'll get in with this Willie here. He's going to. And he said, I don't think there's enough here for two families. And I said, yeah, I told him about Bob Goldwell. I said, Bob Goldwell comes to this place, to this county, in a Model A Ford coupe, and a wife, and a pair of work gloves. That's all he had. He went to work for John Schroeder. And he worked up until he owned damn near $1 million. All his stuff, when I was talking to Willie's son-in-law, said if he'd put all his stuff together right now, he'd be worth $1 million. And so Pete forgot all about being a veterinary. I told him anybody's crazy that want to be a veterinary have to get up in the middle of the night in a snowstorm and go out and take care of a cow.
Did you know Willie's dad?
Yes.
Was he still operating the little mill that he had there in Island City?
I don't think he was then, no. I'd bought seed grain and stuff from him and cow feed from him while I was in the dairy.
Willie learned a lot of things from his dad about cleaning grain and cleaning grass seed. So he has many things that he can do to earn a living, not just raise wheat or cattle or something like that.
I'm going to tell you something hard to believe. But Willie never bought anything that he couldn't pay cash for. If he couldn't pay cash, he never borrowed a dime to buy any equipment with. He had the money there, so he made a lot of money on interest, saving interest and stuff.
I think he learned a lot of that from his dad.
Yeah, he did.
His dad was a good operator.
Yeah. Willie's retired now. His son-in-law's running the layout. But he still does all the cleaning of the seed grain and wheat and stuff. He runs it.
Can you call that retired?
Yeah, he's got a gal out there. Pete hired her. But she works with Willie doing the cleaning stuff.
I've seen her work out there, and she works.
Yeah, she's a real worker.
Yes, she's a real worker.
Yeah. Willie said after I worked for him for 10 years, he said, I got the most work done, had the most fun farming in them 10 years that I did in the whole darn horse working out there. We always...
Well, that's great.
And then when his son-in-law come in, he fit right in with us. But the three of us, the only time we had to have help was in harvest, grass harvest and stuff. And we just...
Well, they've expanded quite a little bit with the mint harvesting there now, and the mint oil.
It takes
several more people for a length of time. But Willie does a lot of work for other farmers.
And he cleans all the green seed, wheat, and barley. They bring their barley in, he cleans it for them, for wheat, and of course he sells his wheat for seed wheat and stuff. It gets an extra dollar or two a bushel for it. So,
what did you think when people started buying most of their milk at the grocery store, and it really wasn't too profitable to for home deliveries anymore, was it?
No. Well, and then state came in, and we'd have to have all stainless steel, and we couldn't just have
regulations.
We couldn't afford it. That's why the Valley Dairy got started.
It's kind of like Frank Young when he used to make cider. They said that you had to have a separate room to store your apples and all these things, and there hasn't been any good cider since because they can't follow all those rules and regulations.
One of the craziest things that I had when I was selling milk, the house deliveries, there was a family there, and one of their kids was having trouble with milk. And the doctor told her that if she could get milk from one cow, just one cow, same milk every day, that's the only way that kid could make it. By God, I milked that one cow. And we'd have to cool it and bottle it separate. Mm-hmm. And we did that for 3 years. Of course, we had to change cows once in a while. The kid made it. He made it, got over all that. But that's quite a chore to separate that one all the time.
I can see that.
Yeah. And I thought some old gal was going to kiss me one time, but I was delivering milk uptown there on 2nd Street. I don't remember her address or don't remember her name or anything. I went there one morning, there's a quarantine sign on the door. God, it took me a little bit of brain figuring to do when I went over to back to Wilcox Grocery and called her up. And I told her, if you need that milk, you put a sign in the door how many quarts you want and a pan on the porch to put it in. And you can stand there and watch me when I bring it, and I'll open the bottles and pour it in your pan and take the bottles. But don't you come out there and get it while I'm there. And that I did all through that quarantine.
Yeah.
And never took any money or nothing. Just it was all in the books.
Well, that's a wonderful thing.
And I don't know how come I was smart enough to think of that, but it just come to me. And I got on the phone and talking to them. Boy, they were tickled to death. And they wanted 3 quarts. They put a sign in the door, and that's what I give them. And then after when the quarantine was over and stuff, I got a pretty nice check, too.
You hardly ever hear of anything being quarantined anymore.
No. That's the first and only one that I run into when I was in delivering milk, though. I don't remember what it was for, either.
I can remember. Sign
on the door, quarantined, and I knew what that meant.
During the war, did that make things harder while you were running the dairy?
Yeah, some damn dinner. Gas rationing.
Yeah.
I had to cook gas. They told me I had to cut my liters in half. Well, like hell, I didn't have no place to keep it over a day and stuff. So I did half her out each day. A little milk got by with that. But it's just stupid. And they told me that because I had trouble getting gas because I was running empty half the time. Well, hell, I wasn't. The truck wasn't empty when I delivered the milk. I had all them empty bottles back in it. I couldn't put nothing else in the truck.
True.
But you just kidding people that don't know what they're doing then.
Well, Nellie Grimmett was a hard taskmaster.
Yes, she was.
She was head of the ration board at the time.
I never had any trouble with her, but one guy, he was a mailman. He delivered mail up in Perry and up that country. He had to have a tire for his car. She said, we ain't got no tires for the car. They got quite an argument. And she said, he said, you're double lucky that you ain't a man. Why? She said, I'd pull you across this car and just beat the hell out of you. You won't use your head for nothing. He stormed out of the joint, and the next morning he had permit for 2 tires. He made a believer out of her right then and there. I got along good with the ration and stuff. They told me when they told me I had to cut down my mileage, but we went to every other day and stuff. And I delivered milk every day. And then they moved from Hot Lake into here. And he said, that's taking it off the wrong end. Well, what the hell difference would it make to him what end if I had to cut my mileage down?
So, yeah.
We had a lot of fun, though. But they don't pay to get mad. I never will forget that guy telling her she was lucky. Wasn't a man. He was big enough, he could have done it too.
You've seen a lot of changes in the valley. What do you think about how things are going?
Well, when I first moved here, in this house, there's a gravel road. And maybe there'd be, 4 or 5 cars a week go by here. And now, it was a gravel road. In the wintertime, the road used to drift for snow between Cemetery and Island City. And it was 3 weeks at one time that I couldn't get to Island City from here without going down here and going toward town and they cut across and coming back to Island City. Until one time, during that time, they had a funeral. They had to bury somebody over here. Well, S.B. Morgan was roadmaster. He come out here with a grader to open that road so they could have a grave out there. And he got stuck out there, and we had a hell of a time getting him out, and he went back to town and put chains on all four tires, or all wheels anyway, and came out and bucked that road out so they could have a funeral. Well, hell, that guy there, he didn't need the funeral. Fast doing him any good or anything. He was long gone. But I delivered milk to Morgan at his house up there. And I told him, I said, I don't know about this here. You went out there and opened that road up to bury a guy out there, but you wouldn't open it up so I could deliver you your milk. He never forgot that. He got a kick out of that, too. But I could shoot a 22 squirrels out here any direction I wanted to. Now you can't even shoot a gun any kind in this out here.
Yeah, there's people all around you.
Too many people that didn't save.
Well, what did you think when they built the Mormon church right next to you?
Well, I thought that was a pretty good deal because they wanted to build it. They wanted to buy 5 acres to build it. And they wouldn't know if I'd sell them 5 acres. I said, yeah, I'd sell them 5 acres. But you'll have to buy the whole 120 because I will not subdivide. Not trying to. So, we made a deal. Now, I don't know how to put this on that thing or not. They formed a partnership, Big Shot Mormons. And we signed a contract. I tried to give it to the state of Oregon College. Tried to give it to Eastern Oregon. They couldn't handle it. One of the lawyers here wanted to go to Whitman, Walla Walla. And Oregon State, I give them a chance. They come out and went all over it. Showed them the boundary lines, the sewer district, the water district, the whole darn thing. And they said, well, you have to have an appraiser, state appraiser. And so we did. And the state appraised it with water and sewer available. $560,000. And so I told them I wanted $28,000 a year for 20 years. If you multiply that out real quick, it comes to $560,000. Well, they signed the contract of these two Mormons, Russell Elmer and Russell Lester. And they hired some lawyers, finally Russell Lester did. They paid 17 and a half years. Russell Lester said it was paid for. He amortized it out and it was paid for. Well, when the accountants up here wanted to figure out a deal like that, they said, you can't do it that way. You can't sell it like that. And I said, the hell I can't. In his mind, it's the first time in my life I had it all paid for. I don't owe a dime on it. If they want to buy it and I want to sell it. And the accountant said, well, he said, you got to have some interest. I said, hell, I didn't ask any interest. I told you I wanted $28,000 a year for 20 years. Well, he said, there's got to be some interest for the buyers. So not for me, but for the buyers. And so they said, well, the only way we can do it is that we'll have to set it up and then back into it to get the interest. After they paid 17 and a half, Russell Lester sued me, said it's paid for. They amortized that out. Now, how in the hell can you amortize $28,000 for 20 years? When the men in school, said he couldn't. Some of this you'll have to cut out of this.
Yeah, well, we'll cut out what you want.
Yeah. He had said they could do it. But Russell Elmer paid half of Lester's last payment and a whole other one of these over the 28th. And by God, they sued it in the old men in school and told him that they he could advertise that out, and I had nothing to do with it anymore. That was it. So they sued me, and I had to pay their interest, old Russell Lester's interest, his lawyers, the price of whole of suing me. That was Mr.
Seems quite ridiculous.
That's why I kept saying, "Oh, my men and ruined the name right. It's men and screwing." But we've been able to live right now. We don't got too much to worry about.
Well, good. How did you and Marie get involved in Neighbor to Neighbor?
Well, I don't know. That was I usually say that's the second mistake I made. First mistake was when they turned me up and first morning they slapped me on the butt and I cried. That was my first mistake. And I think the second one is when we got involved in this neighbor.
You helped a lot of people, though.
Oh, yeah. Still do. I was no better than to get too involved in this wood stuff. And I went out there one day, and we'd had the work crew out here, the county work crew out here. And they always, working with wood, they always had good gloves. And I went out there, and it rained all night. God, there and there was a brand new pair of gloves that wore one part of one day, laying on a block of wood out there in the rain. And so I picked them up. Started leaving, there was another pair down on the ground. And I bent over and picked that up. And when I straightened up, I didn't stop. I just went right over on my butt. Banged my head. It's a damn good thing I didn't break something that I couldn't.
Yeah.
So I quit the wood business. I go out there and straighten them out or help them a little bit, but I don't pile wood or pick up wood and stuff.
But you allow them to use your barn lot out here to store wood and deliver to people that need it.
Yeah, and we got a wood splitter out there. Walmart sold a wood splitter to somebody in Cole. And they hooked it on their trailer for them and they started home and it come loose and went down through the bar feet and up into a guy's grain field. Kind of bunged it up a little bit. They had to go get it and haul it back. So they had old Floyd Knapp to build it back up, put it together again. And so he did. And he come and told me about it, and he said they'll sell it to me for a little. I said, I tell you, I'll buy half of it. You and I buy it, and you can rent it anytime you want to, and we can let the neighbor have it. So that's why we got a wood splitter out there. It ain't mine. I told him that's wood. Neighbor to neighbor wood splitter.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, that's been a lot of darn wood that makes it easier.
Makes it easier.
Well, when the county work crew comes out here, he knows that I'm supposed to be out there. And I'd go out there and help him. I'd run the lever, push the lever. You know. Don't your arm get tired? And I said, yeah, but I got another arm I can use. My guy finally, he told me, he said, you're not supposed to be out here to wood. Well, of course, if I was working and some kid couldn't handle this stick of wood, well, I'd grab it and help him, you know.
Yeah.
So that's why I quit the wood business. There's a lot of people getting a lot of wood out of that out there.
How many cord do you figure a year that they...
How many cord of wood did we put out this last winter?
81 last year, I think it was.
81 cord?
That's a lot of wood.
Yeah.
First couple of years it was 4 or 5.
And how many years have you been involved in the project?
Well, ever since the county got smart and wouldn't give it up, I guess. The county used to do it. The people that would, they quit.
It's been 6 years.
I got so I can walk there, and there's a pair of gloves laying there on the ground. I just step around them.
Yeah, don't want to have any other problems.
After I fell down out there that day, that time, it was only a week, less than a week. And I spent 6 hours in the emergency room up there in the hospital. I don't know what happened. I've got too many operations anyway. But part of my intestine got involved in a hernia in there someplace. Yeah, quite a time up there.
Well, you should be retired on that little project. What does your wife think about you giving all these young ladies kisses, candy kisses?
Oh, boy, that don't go over very big, but you know she buys them for me.
Oh, well.
In the summertime, I don't give kisses. I give these Werther's.
Oh.
And they're kind of expensive.
Yeah.
Some people like them better than the kisses.
You make these girls pretty happy. I notice they all smile.
Oh, yeah. Go to a restaurant and give a girl, get good extra special service and everything.
Well, what fraternal organizations have you belonged to all these years, Roy?
Elks is the main one.
How many years have you belonged to the Elks?
Well, I'm over 50 year, over life member now.
Uh-huh.
I'm still paying my dues, but I don't go very often anymore. We used to like to go to their Wednesday night dinners, because I take Larry, but she got allergies, and there's only certain things she can eat, so... kind of bar that, but then one of the guys that I used to go take all the time, he can't go anymore, and so I just kind of give up on that.
And Dick Charter used to be one of them that you went with?
Yeah. There's one guy, old guy out there, he was with a wall of cane and could hardly walk and stand. So I told his wife, if you take him to the Elks, I don't think bring him home. Oh, they thought that was second heaven. She'd bring him down there and wave at me, and I'd take him home and walk him to the door because he was on crutches or stuff. What's his name?
Henry Stauffer.
Stauffer.
Oh, yeah. I remember Henry.
And then I picked up Carl Stone a lot because he never was that bad off. And there's a Raymond. Somebody by the name of Raymond.
Ray.
Raymond Gray that had the electrical shop.
No, this is what. He lived right there, 2 houses down from Carl.
He was great.
And so I'd pick him up, bring them to him, and then take this other guy home. And so I'm kind of busy.
Is there anything that you wished you had done instead of had a dairy or?
Well, if I really wished. I wish I'd had more sense and kept more of my money when I was a kid. I told you, the first mistake I made was when I cried. Oh, I don't know. I've been pretty damn lucky, pretty happy. But the best thing I ever did was when I married Louie. Goddamn, I didn't know there were so many different places in the world I could go.
Well, great.
We went to Hawaii 2 or 3 times. We went to the Virgin Islands.
Uh-huh.
We went on a trip to Alaska out of Vancouver, B.C. Took a tour boat to, what do you call it?
Ferry.
Up to Alaska. Went around through Alaska and spent quite a bit of time there.
Well, that's great.
Australia and New Zealand.
Australia and New Zealand. And then when we got the trailers, we took Jim and Gail Whitmire.
Uh-huh.
He came to Elks with me, the other one. And Fred and Iris, and then Marie and I took my older sister with us. We went up to Canada for 6 weeks. We spent quite a bit of time up in there in that country. Enjoyed that too.
Oh, great. But, actually, you were eligible for dual citizenship, weren't you? Because weren't you born in Canada?
Yeah. When I got to be 21, I went up here to register to vote.
Uh-huh.
And the guy up there said, you're one of the few people in this country who've got a choice. You can either be a Canadian citizen or American citizen. Well, I didn't know about all the things between Canada and us, so I decided I'd rather be American. But that was funny. I never forgot that I had a choice.
Yeah. But you were born up there.
Yeah, I was born up there. My folks was never, they never was Canadian citizens. They never joined up there. They just moved up there and farmed up there for quite a while. And said I wasn't going to tell any stories on this, but I got to tell you this. We come down after, down here at Stephen, milking cows, and I wanted to pull to build a fence around the haystack. Old Mick Riley lived up there on the edge of Mount Emily.
Mm-hmm.
He had some poles, so we went up there to get some poles. And him and my dad got to talking and bragging. And Bob told him that he had 13 kids. Oh, Riley thought, man. Wow, he said, where did you live? He said, I lived up in Canada. And Riley said, well, he said, that explains it. It was so darn cold up there. My dad said, the cold had nothing to do with it, but the mosquitoes are so bad. And that's the first time in my life I could laugh right straight at my dad without getting. But old Riley, he just darn near fell on the ground. He laughed.
There was a question I wanted to ask you that I read in Baker's Dozen about your family. Was after you graduated from high school, you and a number of fellows went after a pintle horse that was running loose. Wonder if you'd tell us that story.
We went that way. I hunted that horse, but I never got no horse. We couldn't.
You did catch some colts, though.
No, we caught one colt to bring back.
Who all went on that?
Kenny Fearon, Abe DeBoy, Harold Zerbrick, Wilbur and Gene Zerbrick, or Blockman, and Jimmy Dial,
mm-hmm.
and Fred and I. We got up there and got into the snow. We had sleeping bags or equivalent, anyway. And we got fooling around too late, and it was pretty dark.